You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. There's been so many of these now. It's an entire university degree by this point. But we have started February 1st, 2026, somehow. And, There's been some rumors about my health. You know, my heart is giving me a few issues. Nothing life-threatening necessarily. I have to get a stent next week or sometime. My wife handles all that. But it's nothing. You know, if I ignored it, it would be life-threatening. But I have to take care of this now. And I appreciate prayers from the Orthodox people. Listening there, even though this is a very, you know, mass production line kind of job procedure. Today's topic is an extremely complicated one. I mean, actually, everything I talk about is very complicated. The ignoramuses don't realize how complicated these topics could be. And I started it back in 2020. I gotta let Stanley out. Hang on a minute. Yes, Stanley could be very insistent when he wants to leave the house. Actually, you know what? Before I get into that, I do want to remind everybody that my new book is out. Borges Bocinius Crowview, The Foundations and Causes of the Russo-Ukrainian War, 2022-2025. And I'll put this up against anything that's out there now, anything that will be out there. It's the best book I've ever written. I've mentioned this before. The cover is unfortunate and very striking of a Ukrainian graveyard, very large one. And the title is simply Ukrainian for debts paid in blood. And that's exactly what's happening here. There are no more assets to sell. There's no more land. It's all been taken. Ukraine has no independence whatsoever. And now all they have is bodies to send against Russia, who is the force against liberalism in the world, and also has the premier fighting force in the world. Her military, all the bugs have been taken out of it. Her command structure is perfect. Her military industrial production, which is actually owned by the army, is churning out a huge amount of material. You know, no one can take them on. NATO certainly is in no position to take Russia on. You know, it's shocking to see just how weak NATO is. And speaking of which, I may start. I have a new book. I'm thinking of. I have a bunch of essays that I've written over the years on American military weakness and fraud. I have enough for a book. I might do that. I'm not entirely sure yet. I'm also working on a book on Peter the Great. His rule and his revolution. So, but for tonight, we're going a bit before then. The topic here is simply the myth of the Mongol Tartar yoke over Russia. and the subtitle is striking. Medieval Mongolia was Russian. And it was. There's so much material here that I've gone over, and there's still more I need to get over. But the Mongol conquest and occupation of Russia is one of the most significant events in our history, Russian history. It shaped the world. It's not a minor issue. Problem is that there's very little evidence of a Mongol horde. When I say Mongol, I'm going to be using the word Mongol in two different senses. In this sense, I mean East Asian, like where Mongolia is today, conquering and holding Russia for 200 years. It certainly was a war, but it was a civil war among Slavs. The official story that I accepted early in my career can't be sustained. And I was really convinced, there's a lot of reasons to be convinced by this, but contemporary pictures and paintings, sketches of the battles, show two identical armies. You know, painters are always very careful. For example, when the Russians are fighting the Turks, it's very easy to tell who's who, but not here. They are exactly the same. Later on, later paintings show Mongols looking like American World War II anti-Japanese propaganda pictures. They suddenly made them very Asian-looking. It's, you know, just one more thing where everything you know is wrong. And normie life exists in a bubble. It has no connection with reality and enforced by censorship and sometimes prison. This is just one small aspect of that bubble. So the term Mongolia has a confusing history. Medieval Mongolia was a large state that was spread over a territory roughly equivalent to modern Russia. It was not conquered by foreigners. It was originally populated by peoples who traditionally inhabited the place, Russians and Tartars, very closely related to people speaking the same language. They were Turkified later on. To make matters worse, though, and this is where things get nasty, Peter the Great destroyed the local histories, the Mestnichevo, a so-called localism, where noble families had their histories of their conquests and everything else. They were all burnt, or most of them were burnt. Peter wanted everything burnt, really, in the process of his creating the Table of Ranks. But his primary purpose was to destroy any connection of Russians to their... And these are boyars. These aren't oligarchs. And we know that burning them was meant to simply wipe out their existence, to destroy any connection they have with their history, because the system had already been removed by Tsar Fyodor. Medieval Russians were Mongols, but it doesn't make them Asiatic. The name Mongolia, or Mongolia, as Karamzin and many others write, derives from the Greek word megalion, meaning great and powerful. It does not refer to the sparsely populated country between Russia and China. The contemporary sources, the word Mongolia does not appear anywhere. Great Russia does. Now, foreign works, a few of them, especially Polish and British, sometimes call the Russian realm Mongolia, sometimes Tartary, because it was the translation of the Greco-Russian word for great, Great Russia, Great Tartary. If you Google search a Tartar, they are pretty much white people, as far as I can see. So, the so-called Tartar-Mongol yoke comes down to a specific period in history. It's a part of the history of the medieval Russian state. The population of East Slavs were divided in two waves. One was the peaceful civilian population that were ruled by their princes, Kievan Rus. The other, however, was a permanent regular army, the Horde, led by military commanders, usually Russians. The head of the Horde stood the Tsar, or the Khan, same thing, who wielded supreme power. Now you note, if you know your Russian history, Ivan the Terrible did something very similar in 1565. And dividing Russia in this way. The Horde, there was always this back and forth between the two forces. And Moscow paid tribute to the Horde. A tenth of its property, a tenth of its population. When I say population, I mean the tax that was meant to refurbish the army. Conscription of young people. They were drafted into the army at a young age. And the recruited warriors, sometimes we call them Cossacks, they never returned home. This military conscription was the very same tagma, the word blood tribute, that the Russians supposedly paid to the Tartars as if they were a foreign people. They were not. However, this janissaries were something very different in Turkey until the 17th century. However, it was not a tribute from a conquered people to their conquerors. Two foreign peoples. Two different ethnic groups. It was just a normal plan of conscription. And of course, if you don't pay this tribute, the military administration would punish a population with punitive expeditions. This is how it went. The Tartar Mongols were Russian. It was an internal process of the unification of the Russian principalities and the strengthening of Tsarist power in the country. The remnants of the regular Russian army of that time survive to this day, and we call them Cossacks. Well, it's true that Cossacks would admit runaway serfs who fled to the Don in the 16th, 17th centuries. That was not their sole method of recruitment. The Cossacks go back much farther than that. But sources at the time talk about Cossacks everywhere, not just at the Don River, not just in places that were hard to get to. The Yaik, Don, Volga, Terek, Dnieper, Zaporozhian, Pskov, Ryazan. You even had urban Cossacks located in cities. According to the Cossack Dictionary and Handbook, if you look at the article, Zaporozhian Cossacks, the Dnieper or Zaporozhian Cossacks were called Horde Cossacks until the 16th century. Moreover, it says, the Zaporozhians were considered the yurt of the Crimean Cossacks. That's an interesting word. It confirms that the hypothesis that the Cossacks were the troops of the Mongol horde. The word yurt means encampment, dwelling, or village. Constantly used, even today, in Cossack parlance to designate their own camps and settlements. What I'm going to try to do here for the rest of this talk is fill in the details from the show I did back in 2020. It surprises me that if you look up this very thesis in Russian, you'll see the contempt that historians treat it, which is odd to me. You know, they dismiss it immediately. Well, it makes sense since they'd have to rearrange their entire view on Russian history as a whole. but the evidence is overwhelming that no East Asian nomads destroyed the bulk of Russia or occupied the bulk of Russia starting in the 13th century. The royal dynasty of Ivan Kalita is a dynasty of the Horde Khans and Tsars, sometimes even called Khagans. So it's not crazy to call it the Horde Russian dynasty. The Horde period in Russian history spanned the 13th roughly to the 16th century and ended with the Time of Troubles, the last ruler of that being Boris Godunov. Now, most of you know the Time of Troubles ended with the election of the very young Mikhail Romanov. The Romanovs were a family from Western Russia, Pskov to be exact. The Horde dynasty was defeated at this period, and the war ended, and its rule ended. But that dynasty, especially when Mikhail was very young, needed to consolidate its position on the throne. There were certainly other surviving descendants of the previous Horde czars, and they laid claim to the throne once in a while. So the Khans had to be, you know, depicted as this primordial enemy of Russia. And that's where the historical theory about the military confrontation between Russia and the Horde as one between Russia and the Asians, which is a very different interpretation to medieval Russian history. Along with that came the Norman theory that the Russian state really didn't develop until Norman, you know, meaning Viking, until the calling of Rurik gave some order to the trade on the Dnieper, which is also false. And there's a specific group of men who were called on to do this, who were brilliant in many other ways. August von Schlosser, in particular, Gerhard Miller, he actually created the Normanist thesis as a literal court historian under Catherine II, and Gottlieb Bayer. And they kind of created this very Germanocentric view of Russian history. So that, along with the destruction under Peter of the local books of the Boyar clans and histories, this was a revolution. Peter was aware of being a revolutionary. The title of the book that I am in the process of, kind of like three-quarters of the way through, the title is one word, Demiurge. The Russian state included the Tartars. You had smaller groups, Mordvins, Chuvash, and a few others. But talking about Tartars and Russians, as one as conqueror, the other as vanquished, that was simply an invention of these men, and many others too. Mongolia then was shifted geographically to the Far East, and roughly overlapped to the country we know by that name today. There's not a single ancient chronicle that has been found in the territory of modern Mongolia that tells of the campaigns of the Mongol Khan, Batu, or anyone else, or the Russian conquest. What I found striking, and this is even before I thought about this too much, is contemporary Russian writing on the Mongols. They never mention that they're men of different appearance or that they need interpreters. Shockingly, no evidence for a Mongol language has ever been unearthed. The problem with being both a medievalist and a nationalist is that in the Middle Ages, especially, you know, this period of time, it's hard to come to terms with a world where ethnic groups, states, and regions have names that are not standardized. With the advent of the printing press, these drifting and changing of names ceased. It took a long time. Only then did geography kind of become static. Prior to that, and really to a great extent in the East after that, none of these places had static names. It's hard to tell why Russia was called Mongolia for a long time. It was. But it was, simply. Western documents contain direct indications that Russians were called Tartars, too. So in the documents from Roussillon, a French writer, white Tartars are often mentioned alongside yellow Tartars. The names of the white Tartars include Lukia, Marfa, Marina, Katarina. They're Russians. Now, how long the forced conscription into the Horde army lasted, I don't know. There are some sources that say it ceased a very short time later, but you did have mercenaries who joined. Ibn Battuta, an Arab, wrote in his travelogue, "The main mass of armed service and labor forces of the Golden Horde consisted of Russian men." One of the historians, who's actually a mathematician, who developed this theory, he said the following. Let's pause for a moment and imagine the absurdity of the situation. Now, by situation, he's talking about the whole Mongol conquest, being, you know, East Asians. The victorious Mongols, for some reason, hand over weapons to Russian slaves they had conquered. With these, armed to the teeth, quietly serve the conquering army. In fact, making up their main body. Let's remember once again, the Russians had supposedly just been defeated in open and armed combat. Even in traditional history, ancient Rome never armed its newly conquered slaves. Throughout history, victors took away the weapons of the vanquished. If they did recruit them, they constituted a minority and were, of course, unreliable and certainly separate. What do we read about the composition of the troops of Batu Khan? Notes from the Hungarian king and a letter to the Pope were left about the composition of Batu's troops. The king of Hungary at the time said, "The state of Hungary from the Mongol invasion, as from a plague, was for the most part turned into a desert. And like a sheepfold was surrounded by various tribes of infidels, namely Russians, wanderers from the east, Bulgarians, and other heretics from the south." Well, what did he mean by Mongols here? Russians, Bulgarians are mentioned. These are all Slavic peoples. Translate the word Mongol from the king's letter, you get great, Megalian. The great Russians invaded, or at least a powerful group of people invaded. When you go to the ancient sources, the medieval sources, you take the word Tartar or Mongol out of it, and you put the Greek Megalian, it makes sense. In fact, that's the only way it makes sense. I'll quote him again. "Towards the west is necessary to protect the borders of Mongolia against Poland, Lithuania, and Hungary. To observe and protect the borders of this direction, Batu created a military settlement along the bank of the Dnieper and the population brought from the Russian principalities. The settlement covered the territory of the entire horde from the west towards the neighboring Mongol forces. The Supreme Khan, Central Asian military settlements were created along the lines of the Yaik and Terek rivers. The border settlements and the Terek line included Russian peoples North Caucasus, Circassians, Alans, and many others. The most durable defense was required towards the west from the course of the Don, the northwestern borders of the Russian principalities. This served as the settlement of one of the significant groups of Russian people brought from their homeland. From the center of the Golden Horde, Sarai, in all directions, postal lines were established over thousands of miles. Ferries and boat crossings were established in all rivers, also serviced by Russians. The established system of governance of the Golden Horde was exclusively run by Russians. The Mongol state, so-called, or the Golden Horde, was organized and staffed by Russians from the start and at every level. They were everywhere. They were the overwhelming majority of the army, all the vital hubs of the empire. They controlled the lines of communications, I just said, and everything else. Where the hell are the Mongols? Well, you might tell me that they are only in the highest possible command posts. But that's odd. For some reason, they're not overthrown by their conquered slaves. Not only armed and constituting the overwhelming majority of the army, but controlling all of its trade, its river crossings and everything. This is very odd. It's much simpler for the historian to say, no, that this is a Russian state. That this is not a foreign enemy at all. Those revisionists who don't believe, and this is very common in Russia itself, less common, I don't think you hear it at all in the West, but the letters of Plano Carpini, a cleric from Rome passing through Kiev. Now, he got there just as it was conquered by the Mongols. And for some reason, he doesn't mention a single Mongol commander. He doesn't mention anything. He doesn't mention that there's foreigners there. The previous ruler of Vladimir remained just in charge of Kiev as he was before. Carpini saw the first Tartars outside the city of Kanev. Turns out that many important command administrative posts were occupied by Russians. Mongols became invisible beings. So, when you talk about, but they still call them Mongols. So, Carpini's, and of course he's a major source, he's very literate, he's the emissary of Rome. It's really hard to gainsay him. His description of Mongolia doesn't make any sense if it refers to the East Asian state. Here's how he describes its geography. I'm quoting him here. The above-mentioned land, Mongolia, is located in that part of the east where, as we believe, the east connects with the north. To the east of them, that is, the Mongols, is located the land of the Chinese. He mentions nothing about any nation east of Poland, though. He doesn't mention the Gobi Desert. He doesn't mention, China is not to the east of Mongolia anyway. It's possible he's referring to Caucasians. So he can refer to a lot of different people. I don't know what he means by Chinese here, but the word China also was used quite often, not referring to people actually from China. Then, to the south, the land of the Saracens. Now, that can't be right, meaning the Turks. In particular, the Turks that they fought during the Crusades. That definitely can't be right. He has to be referring to a place in Eastern Europe. Then, he says to the west is the region of the Naimans, a Turkic-speaking tribe that no longer exists. No mention of such a people exists in any archive anywhere, but chances are he's referring to the Normans, existing in Germany, France, and at that time South Italy even. Then he says to the north, the land of the Tartars is surrounded by the ocean. Okay, now you know he's not talking about Mongolia. This comes out of Lasovsky and Fomenko's Which Mongolia Did Carpini Visit? Mystery Russian History, Volume 4, Book 2. So clearly he's not talking about the Mongolia that we know. It meant something else. Old Russia would make sense there. He says, on my way back from Mongolia, he came through Poland, Bohemia, Teutonia, and Yodia. That's it. He talks about the climate and other things, none of which would apply to Asia Mongolia. Never mentions the desert, and never mentions how long it takes to get there. He's talking about many time zones away. He's obviously not talking about the Mongolia that we know. I know it gets very confusing, but this is simply how it is. The establishment historians, and even I believe this for a very long time, claim that the Mongol Tartars were these wild, nomadic tribesmen who invaded Russian territory on horseback from the distant borders of China. I think in my first book, I even said there were about 200,000 in number, which was absurd. And I'm very embarrassed by that. But a lot of the contemporary accounts say that there were many of them. They were very numerous. But then, of course, they disappear. There were very few in number. I don't know where these 200,000 men went. Turns out the bulk of the troops were Russian. So it becomes incomprehensible how a handful of mounted savages coming as far away from China could conquer so many powerful civilized countries, even as far away as Egypt, forcing the population of these countries to serve in their army. It gets even better. Concerning the Orthodox Church, let me quote him directly here again. An Orthodox Church was built at the Khan's headquarters from the first days of the formation of the Horde. With the formation of military settlements within the Horde, churches began to be built everywhere. Clergy were called, the church hierarchy was established. Metropolitan Kirill from Novgorod came to live in Kiev. He restored the metropolis of all Russia. Russian princes were called great, middle, and small princes, princes of the Ulus, the Horde Tartar appanage. Metropolitan enjoyed significant privileges from the Mongol authorities. His power in comparison with the princely power was extensive, yet the power of the prince was very limited. The power of the Metropolitan extended to all Russian principalities, including those of the steppe zone. Now, the behavior of the conquerors, consider the Asian Mongolians, staunch pagans, this is very odd. The Russian church's behavior is very strange here too. This would be the only time where the Russian church didn't call upon people to fight against foreign conquerors. This is the one and only time. From the very first days of the conquest, the Russian church supported these alleged foreign pagan Mongols. And it's weird. Metropolitan Kirill arrived and conquered Kiev to Batu Khan from Novgorod. Novgorod wasn't even conquered. Great Russian writers like Nikolai Karamzin, great historians, sometimes he struggles with this too. Here's what he says. One of the consequences of Tartar rule was the rise of our clergy, the proliferation of monks and church estates. Church holdings free from horde and princely taxes prospered. Very few of the current Russian monasteries were founded before or after the Tartars. All the others remained a monument of that time. Is this making any sense to you? In other words, he's saying that almost all Russian monasteries were founded under the Mongols. And the Cossacks, once they leave military service, went to the monasteries, became monastics. It was common practice. Well, since the Cossacks in our thesis, or troops of the Horde, the construction of monasteries in large numbers under the Horde was entirely natural. They became very wealthy. They had the right of duty-free trade. So what we talk about as the Horde, Mongol, Tartars, we're talking about a very extensive conception of the Cossacks. They're the armed forces of the Horde, the Mongol state. That's the only thing that makes any sense. The change in government as the years went on, the Cossack regions of the empire's border retained their original military structure. Cossack settlements of the 19th and 20th centuries delineate the borders of the former Mongol Empire exactly. Now, the time of troubles, or the Great Troubles, changed all of this. And the uprisings with Razin and Pugachev and several others, that's the Horde dynasty exerting itself. And they eventually lost the struggle for the Moscow throne. Razin was probably the last attempt for the old Horde structure to take over. Razin was not a simple Cossack. He was a man of noble origin. Clearly the way he wrote and his agenda, which I've spoken of many times, show that he's at the highest levels of the nobility. There's some foreign evidence that has survived that he was a Tsar of Astrakhan and Kazan. Read Nikolai Kostomarov, Ukrainian historian, and his book Bogdan Khmelnytsky. It's very odd. The Cossacks fought exclusively alongside Tartars. All military operations refer to Cossacks and Tartars as a mixed force. Sometimes even the Polish troops contain Cossacks and Tartars. One gets the impression that all of Ukraine in the mid-17th century was filled with them. The term Tartar here, though, refers to Cossacks, who came to the aid of the Porosian system, the Sikh, from elsewhere, from the south of Russia. It doesn't mean they were Islamic or Turkic. However, when you read Kostomarov in the original, the word Tartar does not exist there at all. Only the word Horde. That's how it's been translated, and I think it's been translated incorrectly. Oh, and you note that in Kostomarov's book, it gives the impression that the Tartars know Russian perfectly. Or at least that all Ukrainians, Russians, and Poles are fluent in the Tartar language. Not a single mention of translators. So what about the historical sources calling Russians Tartars? I mean, Tartars are a group of people that exist today under that name, very loyal, very pro-Russian, have been for a long time. Until the 17th century, Russians, or the Cossack we're talking about here, were called Tartars. Then why is the name of it entirely different today? When and how did the word Tartar change its meaning? And the answer, like everything else, is complex and convoluted. If you go to the list of articles of the Embassy of England to the nobleman Gregory Mikulin and the clerk Ivan Zinoviev, May 1600, June 13, 1401, that has survived. It was published by Prince Oblensky. It gives a detailed account of the embassy of Tsar Boris to England, 1601-02, and it contains the following conversation between the Russian ambassador, Gregory McCullen, and the Scottish ambassador in London. The Scottish ambassador asked Gregory, "How are things with you and your great sovereign, the Tartars?" And Gregory and Ivashko said to the ambassador, "About which Tartars are you talking about? Many Muslim Tartars and the Tsarevichs or many Tartar people serve our great sovereign, His Royal Majesty, the kingdoms of Kazan and Astrakhan, Siberia, many other hordes, the Transvolga Nagai and the Kazanovulas in direct servitude. Beginning of the 17th century, the Russian ambassador didn't even understand the foreigner's question about Moscow's relations with Tartars. He was clearly referring to people alien to the Muscovite state as Tartars, using its word in its traditional, the way we would. The Russian ambassador has a completely different meaning to this. What I just read to you is he's not referring to foreigners as Tartars, only to subjects of the Russian Tsar. He's not referring just to one specific nationality either, but several peoples or communities that were part of the Muscovite state. Also referring to Cossacks as the Horde. Now, when it came to the Crimean state, the Russian ambassador never once used the word Tartar. These were Russians as far as he was concerned. So, in telling a Scotsman about the war with Crimea, he said, "Our great sovereign, Tsar and Grand Duke Boris Fedorovich of all Russia, asking God for mercy, went against him," meaning the Crimean Tsar, "with the Tsar's axe armies, Russian and Tartar and various other states with military forces and many men." Again, Russians and Tartars are subjects of the same Tsar, speaking the same language. The Crimeans, then, are not Tartars in the modern sense we use today. That distinction arises in Western Europe. In Russia before the 17th century, Tartars referred to the military communities of Cossacks, Volga Tartars especially. In Western Europe of the 17th century, the term Tartar began to be mistakenly applied only to Crimeans and Muslims of the Volga region. And that puts the Scotsman's question into some context. How are things with your great sovereign, the Tartars? So he clearly misunderstood the Russian system. So when the Romanovs were able to take power, the word Tartar was then given that designation and more or less standardized. You also need to keep in mind that names common in Russia in the Middle Ages weren't necessarily the same as those used today. Modern Russian names are from usually Greek or biblical origin, you know, Ivan, Maria, Alexander, Tatiana, whatever. But those are baptismal names, names included in the Orthodox calendar. And then they were used in everyday life. They had another name beside their baptismal name. And sometimes there were names like Ahmad or Batu or whatever. So it's very easy for the names to be difficult. I'll give you more detail here. In the study by E.P. Karnovich, Family Nicknames and Titles in Russia, he writes, "God names in Moscow were very often replaced not only by other Christian ones, but also by Tartar ones, for example, Bulat, Murat, Akhmat, so that from such substitute names, half-patronymics were derived, which later turned into family nicknames of Russian people. So you were born as, you know, Akhmat, but then you were baptized. It was the name that you took on the calendar. So the name Batu is not necessarily, it is a Russian name. Another report by the historian Gordiev, he says, among the Don Cossacks, there were a strong layer of the population of Tartar origin. During the reign of Basil III, many of the Ottomans with Mongol Tartar names were known. According to the historian Sergei Soloviev, the numbers of Ottomans with Tartar names was greater than the mounted Cossacks. At the time of the beginning of the reign of Ivan Vasilevich, so that is Ivan III, Ivan the Great, at the head of the Don Cossacks, both mounted and lower, Ottomans exclusively with used Russian names became better known. Fedorov, Oblonsky, Yanov, etc. It's very important. Tartar names were born by Russian men and vice versa. I'm not talking about separate peoples here. Today, of course, they are. But not at the time. Mainstream historians talk about the reaction of Central European leaders to the first Tartar invasions of Russia, Mongol invasions of Russia. This threatening news had spread all over the place, even to Rome. S.A. Aninsky reports that one of the earliest European descriptions of Eastern Russia is a letter by the Hungarian missionary Julian about the Mongol War. Let me quote him here. This has to be unpacked, but just bear with me. The country from which the Tartars originally came is called Gotha. Some manuscripts say Gothia or Gotha. The first Tartar war began like this. There was a ruler of the country of Gotha named Gugutia. There was a certain leader in the country, the Cumans, named Vitut. Another leader from the Buzz River, named Gureg, attacked him, Vitut, because of his wealth, and won. The defeated one fled south to the Sultan. The Sultan, having received him, hanged him. The two sons of Vitut returned to the aforementioned Gureg, who had previously robbed their fathers and themselves. He killed the elder, tearing him to pieces with horses. The young one fled to the aforementioned Tartar leader, Guguta, and earnestly began to ask for revenge. This was done. After achieving victory, the young man asked the leader Gugut, every time it's different, to take revenge on the Sultan. He readily agreed, and having marched against the Sultan, he was victorious. Having victories worthy of praise almost everywhere, the Tartar leader Gugut marched against the Persians. He won a most honorable victory and completely subjugated the Persian kingdom. Having become even more daring after this, he began to march against other kingdoms, intending to subjugate the whole world. Therefore, approaching the country of the Cumans, he subjugated their army. The Tartar army is divided into four parts. One approached Suzdal, another the borders of Ryazan, the third against the Don River, and the castle of Voronezh. And the first reader, Gugut, who started this war, died at the time. Now his son, the Khan, reigns. Now that sounds like a mess. But there's a lot of information here. It seems that the Tartar Mongols are from Gothia, the famous medieval state inhabited by the Goths. Everyone knows the Goths lived in New Europe between Romania and Russia. Did they come from Europe? Is that what they're talking about? That's what the ancient text says. You could say, well, the missionary was mistaken about the identification of Tartars with Goths, or it's a fantasy, or a typo, or a mistake, or something. However, he's not alone. Tartars were consistently identified with Goths in the Middle Ages, sometimes called Little Scythia. In the 16th century, Herberstein writes that Moscow, the Polovtsians, were called Goths. The Russians claim that the Volscians are Goths, he says. At the same time, it's well known that the Russian chronicles, Tartars were often referred to as Polovtsians. Thus, according to the Muscovites of the 16th century, Tartars were considered Goths. The Byzantines called the Russians Turocisians. Actually, that was Leo the Deacon who called them that. So the terms Russian and Tartar are really indistinguishable. So there's more than one source that says that this army came from Gothia. You know, there was an archdiocese there that came under Russia, at least to the 18th century. The renowned historian of the Russian church, the great Kartashev, says that the stream of Christianity flowed to the future Russia through Crimea, which served as a cultural bridge for Russia to Byzantium. Here, Christianity was found among the Greeks and the Goths. And then Leek lists all the Greek dioceses of Crimea around Sevastopol and Suzak. And then he says, the remaining parts of Crimea fell under the ecclesiastical influence of the Goths, who settled there permanently, who didn't want to follow their fellow tribesmen, who left for Italy with Theodoric in the middle of the 5th century. He also says, the Crimean Goths had their own Gothic diocese. The Gothic region extended along the coast from Alushka to Vlkavla. The Gothic archbishop in Dori even outlived the Gothic nation itself. Eventually was either Greekified or Turkified. In the 18th century, and only with the title of Gothic, though with a Greek flock and hierarchy, came under the jurisdiction of the Russian Synod after the conquest of Crimea by Catherine II. Okay, so far, you know, trying to figure out who the Mongols or Tartars actually are is a difficult job. But the myth of the Mongol invasion will not die. According to the historian Yuri Petukhov, he says the myth of the Mongols from Mongolia in Rus is the most colossal and monstrous provocation of the West as a whole against Russia. A closer examination of the issue reveals too many inconsistencies and facts that contradict the classic version. Now, of course, it's one thing to explain and give all the reasons why East Asians could not have possibly done this. It's another thing to figure out who the hell, you know, what was this war about? There was a war there. But for now, here's some of the more logical problems that have been around for a long time against the existence of this East Asian, of all peoples, Mongols. You're talking about people who were described as half-wild shepherds. You know, they were warlike. And they were able to crush developed powers, China, Central Asia, many other kingdoms, fight their way through the Caucasus Mountains. You had all these warlike tribes there, scattered and subjugated dozens more to crush the rich Volga, Bulgaria, and Russian principalities. Almost went to Europe, scattering the armies of the Hungarians, Poles, and German knights. After all this heavy fighting with the Rus, the Alans, the Volscians, the Bulgars, and yet without any developed economy. I don't care if it's, you know, a modern military with an air force and any army that goes through a war of attrition has to have a functional economy with the, you know, a proto-industrial sector. All conquerors had it. Rome was the leading European power in producing these things, weapons and everything else. Alexander the Great relied on the economy established by his father, Philip. But there's no mention of anything like this concerning the Mongols. Now, if Genghis Khan was who we're told he is, you know, he wouldn't be able to function. No matter how, you know, there's no way that, for example, Alexander could have done anything if his father, Philip, had not created a powerful mining and metallurgical industry, strengthened finances, series of military reforms and standardization. Napoleon, Hitler had a very powerful and developed states in Europe. The British Empire, of course, was the heartbeat of industrialization. But what did the Mongols have to rely on? Nothing. They were poor nomads, primitive herders and hunters, low stage of communal development. Nothing wrong with it. I'm not passing judgment, they're not backward or anything, but they didn't even create a pre-state structure, let alone a Eurasian empire. There is no way they couldn't that they could crush any developing power at the time, let alone with relative ease. It required production and a military base, as well as cultural traditions, which are built over many generations. But beyond that, the Mongols at the time didn't have the necessary demographic potential to create a large and powerful army, especially with the numbers that I used to believe were true. Today, what is Mongolia today? It's a deserted, sparsely populated country with minimal military potential. 1,000 years ago, or it was even poorer. Small clans of shepherds and hunters. There was no source for tens of thousands of well-armed and organized fighters who'd go on to conquer China and everything in their path. While nomads and hunters had no chance of almost instantly, a very short period of time, becoming this invincible military people, crush the leading powers of Asia and Europe in the shortest possible time. It doesn't make sense, and if it doesn't make sense, it isn't true. The nomadic culture of Mongolia and the handful of people who lived there lacked the corresponding cultural, military, economic, demographic potential. There was no military revolution like the development of the phalanx or the legion, you know, everything else. And yet we're told about the myth of the invincible Mongol warriors that were described in the wonderful historical novels of Vladimir Young. But it's a myth. In terms of weaponry, what are called Mongols were no different than Russian warriors. Numerous archers in the tradition of archery are an ancient Scythian and Russian tradition. A clear and uniform organization, cavalry troops were divided into tens, hundreds, thousands, and the Tumens Temni, the 10,000 corps, led by Desiatics, Centurions, Thousands, and Temniks. Those weren't inventions of the Mongols. Russian troops were always organized that way. They used a decimal system in this case. They had iron discipline. Everything that the Mongols of the Middle Ages were said to do, the Russians were known for, especially conducting offensive actions. The Russians had known siege warfare long before the Mongol invasion, so-called. It simply doesn't make sense. And I don't buy it. And that's just the beginning. That's just a smattering. And I think I said that 6 years ago. But I didn't want to mention it again. Medieval documents, contemporary documents, terms like Khan and Kagan are used alongside those as, you know, prince or czar. We're going to get into that. This may be a two-parter, I'm not sure. But as you know, I've never accepted the concept that Tsar does not come from Caesar. That is simply not true. White Russia, or the White Horde, called Lithuania, also emerged this period of time. The Golden Horde of the Volga region had its center at Novgorod. And Vladimir Suzdal Russia, considered the senior element here, the headquarters of the Khan, or the Grand Prince, was located there. That was a period of state building. A system of military-civilian governance was developed. These weren't foreigners. These weren't Tartars. Or at least not in the sense that we use the words today. They were called Khans in the sense that supreme power was concentrated in the hands of these men who were also military leaders. You had a supreme Khan or a grand prince. These were all Russians. But civil princes presided over the cities. They collected, a tenth of the property, a tenth of the population, as I mentioned before, for the benefit of the horde. But this led to the Russian-Mongol empire being very large and having a very numerous military force. It was almost exclusively cavalry. As I mentioned, the Cossack warriors recruited as children and did not marry. They were strictly forbidden from engaging in agriculture. But you need an army like that. You need food with military warehouses, winter camps, and all that stuff. Special encampments with warehouses were created for this purpose, and it came to be known as sarai. In the Russian language, sarai still means a warehouse or a storage facility. It's not necessarily a place. We're told that the capital of the Golden Horde is Sarai in southern Russia, and yet all the excavations down there have shown zero. And it goes farther than that. The communication route through the vast empire dates back to the Horde era. In the center of the Golden Horde, postal lines were established in all directions for thousands of miles, servicing up to 400,000 horses. An entire army of personnel were supplied. Yamskoy is a term for post station. It means a few things, but... And they were installed every 25 miles along all lines, on which up to 400 horses were stationed. Movement was roughly a speed of 250 miles a day. Horse communications were duplicated on foot, runners who ran 25 miles daily. As I mentioned before, ferries and boat crossings established on the rivers. And every bit of this, from top to bottom, was Russian. It doesn't make any difference what name that they were given at the time. They had Russian names. They functioned as Russians. But they created a very impressive communication system and survived in Russia until the end of the 19th century. And the railways, of course, took it over. The Horde Empire became quite wealthy. A lot of sources talk about the Volga fell into the hands of the Tartar Mongols, a major trade route, becoming very active in the 14th century. The Don being another one, of course, controlled by the Tartars. Everything you could think of. Arab authors from the 13th to the 14th centuries wrote that many Russian ships sailed along the Volga. International trade was one of their main activities of the Russian state at the time. Russian merchants were constantly mentioned in Horde documents. Foreigners don't distinguish them from Mongol merchants. But the word Sarai, the so-called capital of the Golden Horde, you see it in many Russian city names. Saransk, Sarapul, Sarny, Saratov, Tsartsian. And the word Tsar itself is like a variant of the word Tsar, which is noted, by the way, by great writers like Morozov. We see the presence of the name Sarai as far as the Balkans, close to Sarajevo, in fact. has nothing to do with Caesar. Let me try to summarize here. I know there's a lot of information, but when you live in an era that doesn't have standardized names for things or standardized spellings for things, you have to be very careful when reading ancient documents or medieval documents. The names, Russia, Rus, Tartary, Mongolia, or you know the Greek version, the Great Russia, were interchangeable and continued to be so really until the 17th, 18th century. That's the problem. And if you read the literature, especially the Russian literature, scholars like get bits and pieces of the topic, but they don't bring it to its final conclusion. And beyond all of this, there are no signs, zero genetic signs of actual Asiatic Mongols among Russians. You would think that a large-scale invasion of hundreds of thousands of warriors and a prolonged yoke, I think there'd be a little bit. How many armies of Mongols marched through Russia? Driven away many thousands of Russian women to their camps? You would have something. There's nothing. And no evidence for any of this. There's no genetic evidence. They are simply an Aryan peoples. Russians are. Polish and German Russophobic historians. I mentioned a few of them already. And then later, you know, Peter the Great, of course, absolutely had a motive to see old Russia as this Mongol primitive empire that he needed to reform. Developed the theory of Russians as Asians. Poles and many Germans developed the myth that Russians are a mixture of Mongols and, you know, in the Asian sense, and the Finno-Ugrins. And the only true descendants of the Kievan Russian people are the Ukrainians. But again, I've written on the genetic studies on the topic. There is no actual Asian Mongol features anywhere. Russians are purely Caucasian peoples. Now, it's true, later on you had Central Asians that came into the service of the Horde who had you know, Asian features. You see this in you know, Kazakhstan and etc. Tajikistan. That was a different story. That has nothing to do with the topic. That's much later. So all of these fables, these, you know, brilliant horsemen and iron archers who conquered most of the planet, it's a myth. Invented by a very specific category of men in the West, promoted by the Petrine state to distort the history of Russia, of Europe, and really of humanity as a whole. The true Russian then, especially in Peter's era, the Russian was transformed into a savage Asian tribe that needed the Germans to come and create their first state under Rurik. They needed the Vikings and the Greek missionaries to come and create them. Now, the Romanovs did this throughout their existence, assuming that the Romanov line didn't die with Peter, which is very possible. But this is sort of what, you know, you had actual court historians under Catherine II. Catherine II being very German, she spoke Russian with a very heavy accent. This is music to her ears. But I'm seeing these films where Genghis Khan is, you know, you're like a Chinese actor, Even in Europe, the engravings, Mongols are depicted as Russian Cossacks, or boyars, or strelitz, or something like that. Mongolia doesn't have the potential for any of this even today. At this point, I think to believe in the literal Asiatic Mongol control over Russia for 200 years is simply a matter of delusion. Mongolia, the actual Mongolia, East Asian Mongolia, simply lacked the developed industrial and material culture to arm not just thousands of warriors, hundreds of thousands of warriors. No advanced manufacturing, no crafts. Wild steppe dwellers couldn't become blacksmiths overnight. And we're saying this happened within just one lifetime. Metallurgists, builders, engineers, great warriors, all in one generation. So the term Mongol Tartars eventually became standardized as something quite fictitious. It doesn't exist in the Russian sources, and there's nothing in the Mongol sources. Actually, it was as an ethnonym. It was used the first by P. Naumov in 1823 in the article on the attitude of Russian princes to the Mongol and Tartar Khans from 1224 to 1480. The consensus is that the term Mongol comes from the Chinese characters that mean Mingu, roughly meaning to receive something ancient. In the original form, they are the Mughals, as they're called in India. They come from the root word Mog or Moj, which means husband, could mean also powerful and mighty one. The great or great Russians created the greatest empire in Eurasia, not these people. The only people who had the economy to build an empire that the court historians are talking about were the Russians of the Scythian-Siberian world, by far the most powerful ethnic group in the vast forest steppe zone of Eurasia. And they were often called Mongols or Tartars, depending on who you read. And don't forget, Mongols and Tartars were enemies until roughly the early 12th century. Nothing wrong with the Tartars. Some of them were Turkified, some of them were not. They always were very loyal to Moscow. The Chuvash would be the descendants of these Mongols. They have no conception in their literature of controlling all of Russia. The great Mongol horde, so to speak, is made up of Scythian Siberian tribes from the Volga, great Russians, including Polovtsians and Alans, who are Slavic tribes, not from East Asia. The horde is a direct heir to great Scythia and Sarmatia, the ancient northern traditions and civilization of Indo-Europeans. At the height of their power, the Russians controlled northern Eurasia and influenced the development of all South Asian civilizations, including the Persian and the Indian. But in terms of Asian Mongols, they simply weren't present. However, it was very convenient for the Mongols. They needed a new history. The Romanovs, they needed a new history that would justify their presence, and certainly would justify Peter's revolution. Because the Romanovs were not related to Rurik, they were worried about how they were seen, about their legitimacy, despite their being elected. So it was in their interest to create essentially a new interpretation of Russian history, and bringing both Russian and German writers to do it. Well, histories. It was really hard to, too many people were cut off from the actual history. So my job as a historian becomes very, very difficult. So the Horde conquest is declared a foreign victory, a foreign conquest, a Tartar-Mongol yoke. The Russo-Mongol Horde, one thing, an empire existed from the 14th to the 17th century. This era ended at the time of troubles, after the death of Ivan IV. Because of the violence and turmoil and foreign occupation, Romanovs came to power. Even before Peter, they carried out a purge of the historical sources. They caused a massive schism in the church. And there was a great drive to establish unity with the West. But simply a falsehood. This is not necessarily anything against the Romanovs. It's certainly something against Peter and his successors in the Petrian Revolution. Russian history continues to center around that revolution. What's specific about the Russian revolutionary mind came from Peter as a demiurgos, the demiurge. The imperfect builder of the world, who of course was not all powerful, was created. And he was to recreate it. The lack of any unity between the elite and the people that came because of this led to more turmoil under Peter the Great and finally 1917. The Asiatic Mongol Horde stuff is a myth. There were Cossacks, there were Russians. And the war we talk about, that's what we read about, so-called Mongol invasion, was a battle between the princes and the Cossacks. I know it's very difficult. I've explained to you why it's very difficult. But I thank you for bearing with me. I thank you for listening. I will talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.